on me that I didn't know anything about his wife, his family. And as you said, there's only, I'd read lots of books and lots of stuff on Buddha and Siddhartha for many, many years. And I vaguely remembered that he had been married and left them one night and went to seek enlightenment. Then everybody focused on him seeking enlightenment and teaching for over 40 years and the Dharma and the truth and all that brought. But nobody said anything about her or her life. And all of a sudden I thought, I want to find out more about her. So when I came back to the States, I started looking in trying to find research about it. And at the time, there was no internet about 20 years ago. So I went to Stanford and Berkeley libraries and found any texts I could. And I only found a few lines, about two or three lines written about her from some Pali texts that were translated into English. And all it said was that she was the daughter of so-and-so, he was the son of so-and-so, both their parents were kings, and they were married when she was 16, 19, and he left them both in the middle of the night after their newborn son, their only child, was born, named Rahula, which means a hindrance or to hold back, which is interesting. And then that's about all that was mentioned. I was wondering, my gosh, that must have been sort of upsetting. And I thought this would be a fascinating book to write from her perspective on what life was like for her. So over the years, I sort of formulated the story and found a lot of historical fact as much as I could about their family members and how they did react that's been passed on by oral traditions and stories for many years.
And Gabriel, I forgot to mention your upcoming local book event. Can you mention the, do you know the date?
I believe it's September 9th, I think, at the Capitola Book Cafe around 7 or 7:30. There'll be more information about it. I'll be speaking about the novel. I've been going to some other places recently. I just got back from Toronto at a large Indian festival, Masala Masti Mendi, and it was pretty exciting speaking there about it. And a lot of folks from South Asia were very interested in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm curious to hear how the book is being received. There's a lot of different people who are interested in Buddhism and call themselves Buddhists, and they might have a variety of ways of viewing how you're writing about Yashodhara, the Buddha's wife, and about the Buddha himself. There are parts of the book where, because you've chosen the point of view of Yashodhara, the wife that's been left behind with the son, she's expressing anger towards the Buddha. And even at some points is saying out loud, I'd like to kill Siddhartha. I'd like to kill this person that's known as the Buddha. And also...
And you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. Coming up next, Bathrop Spears Broadsides with a special phone interview with Homeless Service Center Director Doug Loisel, who's en route to Los Angeles at the moment, but who promised to call in. Thank you, Doug. Or perhaps we'll call him. Also, we're hoping to get a call from Sacramento's John Paints, or actually Crantz. Sorry about that, John, who we talked to a couple weeks ago. He was at the middle of the Sacramento Tent City Homeless Protest Safe Ground action that is currently sort of in retreat along the American River and was on the property of Sacramento attorney Mark Maron, who is the lead attorney in the Lair lawsuit, the federal lawsuit against the sleeping ban activities of the Sacramento police agencies against homeless people up there in Sacramento. Also, lots of interviews. We hope your comments. You can call in 427-3772. 427-3772. Second number is 469-3119. You might want to try that. And stay tuned.
trust a simple mountain lad, hunting meat for Ma and Dad. He would go out in the mountains in depression days so sad. With a bow and arrow straight, he'd put meat upon the grate of the fireplace in the cabin, where he learned to love, not hate. Earl Durand, born too late, a mountain man. He was shot down in the Tetons by the law's bloodthirsty band. Bound and lightly crag to crag, Earl Durand would hunt the stag. Elk and moose neat too he brought, just to fill his hungry bag. Skinned him out and used the hides to keep warm his young insides. With a buckskin clothes he wore on his lonely mountain rides. Earl Durand, born too late, a mountain man. He was shot down in the Tetons by the law's bloodthirsty band. One day with meat so raw, Earl was captured by the law, hauled away to Cody jail, bedded down on a cot of straw. Then he fled into the hills, leaving behind the city's ills. When the lawmen came to get him, Earl those greedy hunter's drills. Earl Durand, born too late, a mountain man. He was shot down in the Tetons by the law's bloodthirsty band. About 6'2", 250 pounds, he was a crack shot. Throw a marble in the air and he'd shatter it in a million fragments every time. He went to high school for a while, but he didn't dig that scene very much, and so he took off into the mountain wilderness there, the Wind River Mountains of Wyoming. Started living off the land, making his own clothes out of buckskin. Let his hair grow out, let his beard grow. Well, the folks back in town, they didn't dig his scene very much either, so one day they hauled him in for hunting elk out of season. Found him guilty, sentenced him to 6 months in jail. Well, from where he was at, in his jail cell window, he could see the Wind River Mountains, the mountains that he loved. But then one day the DA come in, started talking to him about some rich rancher's cattle that had been shot, about pinning the whole thing on him. So Earl says to the DA, he says, well, if I'm found guilty of that, what's it going to mean? So the DA says to him, well, you'll have to spend 2 years in the state penitentiary at Rawlins. Now, 2 years is an awful long time, and from Rawlins' jail cell window, he wouldn't be able to see those mountains that he loved. So one day when the guard come in with his breakfast, he conked him over the head with a milk bottle. When he come to, he told him to drive him out to his folks' place. He sent him back to town with a message then that he didn't want to kill nobody. He just wanted to live free as he wanted to live. But that if they come after him, he'd shoot to kill. So the sheriff and his deputy, they come out after him. He shot them both and he took off into the hills. In the wilderness he lay, changing lair from day to day. Come to town to get some shells, see his folks, then get away. Earl Durand, born too late, a mountain man. He was shot down in the Tetons by the law's bloodthirsty band. When Park County got too hot, Earl decided to change his spot. Rambled down through Yellowstone to the Tetons at a trot. Then the sheriff swore so hard, he called out the National Guard. And with howitzers and mortars, they played down their last whole card. Earl Durand, born too late, a mountain man. He was shot down in the Tetons by the law's bloodthirsty band. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, howitzers and mortars after one lone man sitting up there in a ridge, and the National Guard, too. They sent two men up after him and hollered up, Earl, you know we got you, so why don't you give yourself up? Well, from about 1,000 yards, he picked them both off with 2 shots. Come nightfall, he'd slip through the lines and go out and get himself some food, and then before dawn, he'd slip through the lines again and get back up in the ridge and play their games with them. Pretty soon he was out of ammunition, so he cut off his beard and cut off his hair with the knife that he had up there. He come down to the line then, and he says to the man there, Say, have they got that Earl Durand fella yet? The guy says, Nope. So Earl Durand says, Well, I'm about out of ammunition. The other guy says, Well, I'm about out too. So Earl says to him, Well, how about driving us both to town? We can get some more ammunition. So the guy drove them both to town. Earl, he went into the bank where he had some money. Town folk heard he was in there, and they gathered outside. Earl, he come out with a bank teller in front of him at gunpoint. So Some trigger-happy 16-year-old kid shot him from the crowd, and by reflex action, he shot and killed the teller. And then he shot, turned his own gun into his own self, and he shot himself. Someone later asked the kid how he felt about killing that notorious outlaw feller, Earl Duran. Kid said, sick. But Earl was free as air, and down from his mountain lair, he'd slip through the lines at night, and at dawn he'd not be there. Till at last with food all gone, and his stomach pinched and drawn, he faced them in the twilight, and their bullets cut him down. Earl Duran, born too late, a mountain man. He was shot down in the Tetons by the law's bloodthirsty band. Earl just wanted to live free, just the same as you and me. But the game law said, oh no, and so this free soul had to go. And his flight was called a crime, although in an earlier time he'd have been a mountain man instead of shot down in his prime. Earl Duran, born too late, a mountain man. Call the Tarzan of the Tetons, kill the civilization's hand.
That was The Ballad of Earl Duran, sung by Charlie Brown and written by Jack Langham. The story of Earl Duran, according to the liner notes, is true. The song was written by Jack Langham, a Wyoming songwriter. Duran, a resident of Powell, Utah, was first arrested on the 2nd of December, 1937, for buying furs without a license. Second arrest, chronicled in this song, was on the 13th of March, 1939, and resulted in a six-month prison sentence. Duran was an avid outdoorsman and crack shot. He killed himself in the Powell Bank rather than be captured after eluding the police. The story happened pretty much as the song reports. Langan, in a letter to Moses Ash at Folkways Records, which released this song, informed him that he had actually written both the words and the music, but the singer had changed the melody to fit his own needs. The song of Duran drew interest in the 1960s, because public fascination with the image of a great Western outlaw still existed in the United States in the mid-20th century. A Hollywood movie was produced on Duran, starring Peter Haskell, Martin Sheen, Keenan Wynn, and Slim Pickens. I never heard of that one. This scenario repeated itself again in the 1980s with a Western outlaw, Claude Dallas, who also became the subject of songs and inspired a motion picture. Dallas was eventually captured in a 7-Eleven in California, a fate Duran did not share. And we'll be hearing some more from Folkways. And maybe we'll be hearing from you. This is Bathrobe's Piers Broadside, the name of the show. I'm Robert Norris, and I talk about civil rights, or the rights we'd like to have in Santa Cruz, and the problems we're having, particularly folks who are on the streets, folks who are poor, struggling renters, people who are fighting for sort of basic rights to use public spaces. And I encourage you to call in with your own stories if you had some concerns about landlords or police or merchants, or maybe you got some positive things to say about stuff that's happening in Santa Cruz. There is, of course, a city council meeting on Tuesday. I didn't make it, but I did read the Santa Cruz Urinal, or the Sentinel, as it calls itself, and their description of the WHAM turn of events. WHAM is Women and Men Medical Marijuana group that essentially supports ill people using medical marijuana, though it's a very relatively small group, and it's run by the Corrals. They have a yearly thing called WHAM Fest, which probably most listeners of this station, most regular listeners, already know about. It's held in San Lorenzo Park coming up this Saturday, and they usually have there's usually marijuana smoking going on. However, since there's a new law, though it's not officially in effect yet, but actually it is as a regulation in San Lorenzo Park, which makes it illegal to smoke in that park and now at numerous other places around the city, that also passed the city council on Tuesday. there seems to be a possibility, and according to this story, maybe even a probability, that people who are smoking marijuana openly, even if it's for medical purposes, will be cited by the police. That's what one of our police officers, spokespeople, claimed. I'm going to go to that story online, see if I can actually check it out, and perhaps in terms of some of the comments that have been made about it. I've often been critical of WHAM kind of from the left because I regard it as a group that's particularly favored by the city council but has itself not used its position of relative power to help out the rest of the community that doesn't have access to a medical marijuana or recreational marijuana for that matter. And I've talked about it at length on Free Radio, and I've written about it on Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. In case you want to read, just go there and check out Google for, or I should search for Robert Norris or medical marijuana. You'll find my own take on the hypocrisy of the city council, the collusion of groups like WHAM in that hypocrisy, which essentially gives them a favored position for 5 years, denied access of all other groups to medical marijuana. The dispensaries couldn't open between 2000 and 2005. And now we have the medical marijuana moratorium that WHAM has had nothing to say about publicly that I've read. Maybe there's something I've missed, could be, which essentially gives a monopoly to the two existing clubs, is likely to cause higher prices, denies people access to medical marijuana locally who are having trouble with those clubs or find the prices too high or can't be served by them. And it's really part of the reefer madness hysteria, as I call it, that is really happening in different places in the state. And I'm hoping to have as a guest maybe next week. I've actually been emailing back and forth with him, Fred Gardner, who's a writer for Counterpunch, a writer for the Anderson Valley Advertiser, a writer for O'Shaughnessy's, is it O'Shaughnessy's Review or O'Shaughnessy's Weekly? He's a very articulate and reasoned and sort of thorough researcher, or at least he seems to be a pretty thorough researcher. I haven't actually trod through his research and done any checking, but he writes a lot of stuff that certainly sounds interesting to me about marijuana and about the latest developments in the fight against the prohibitionists, against the drug law crazies who want to continue this essentially insane criminalization of marijuana, and I would extend that to other drugs as well. Whether it's a plot by the pharmaceuticals or in the interest of the police department or some sort of fundamentalist pseudo-Christian nonsense, I don't know. But I know that it impacts the lives of hundreds of thousands of people, even marijuana users. I think there were 800,000 marijuana arrests last year nationally and rising. And that counts, I suppose, citations as arrests, I'm guessing. And it hasn't necessarily dropped in Santa Cruz. I don't have the resources or the time, or perhaps I don't make the time, to get the stats from the local sheriffs and the local authorities as to how many people they're citing and arresting for marijuana use. But I'm not aware that it's dropped. And I know we've reviewed how Measure K, the medical marijuana, the recreational marijuana, all marijuana use being supposed to be the lowest priority in Santa Cruz, that commission, which was created not by the city council but by the voters, has really been sidelined, defanged, and stacked with essentially pro-police people who don't want to really review what the police are doing. Now we have this WHAM situation where even WHAM itself, which used to get one day a year where sick people could come, and if they had to medicate, they would medicate, which is legal for them to do under Proposition 215 and SB 420, although there actually is a question there. SB 420 is pretty rigid. It has a 1,000-foot setback requirement from recreational facilities of different kinds, and it's always been a question to me about whether I don't think anybody's I'm not aware anyone's been prosecuted under SB 420, or I should say under state anti-marijuana law without SB 420 being the saving grace. It's still true that you can be arrested even if you have a medical marijuana card with marijuana, even if you can prove you're using it for a medical condition. It's just that they can't, once you get to court, they have to drop the charges, but they still can arrest you. Although I guess you can try to show in a civil lawsuit that you are that the arrest is a false arrest because they know they are going to lose it. Sort of similar to the sleeping ban arrests and the reason that Los Angeles, San Diego threw out their sleeping ban under federal court pressure, because the federal court said, look, there's been a ruling by your state Supreme Court that the necessity defense applies to anybody arrested for sleeping outside. That is, they can say, I had to sleep, I had nowhere else to go. And if the police know this when they cite you or arrest you, they are, in essence, punishing you for something that is not a crime and that they know is not a crime and that they know cannot be successfully prosecuted as a crime. And that is what makes the Santa Cruz sleeping ban essentially not only unconstitutional and illegal, but a financial liability for the city, because if we actually had some lawyers with balls and resources, then we could actually sue the city and, I think, success and win, as other cities like Laguna Beach and Fresno have done. And we have, for example, a chief ranger, and I continue to bring this fact up, John Wallace, who is quite candid in saying he destroys homeless property when he finds it up in the Poganepin camps, even though it is, and I was seeing this verified earlier today as I was reading online, it's state law. You cannot destroy property, even as a private citizen. If you find property that's worth over $100, you're obligated to turn it into the law enforcement authorities, and they're obligated to store it for 90 days. That's just state law. You don't need any special federal ruling. But in Fresno, and the Kincaid case, which we've talked about on the air, and we've had people calling in from Fresno, and activist Mike Rhodes has called in. You can read about his stuff online on indiebay.org/Fresno. Federal Judge Wanger ruled $2.3 million fines for the city of Fresno and some associated agencies because they were destroying homeless property. And Wallace, our chief ranger, knows that. I think he knows that. I think I've mentioned it to him. Dinette Shoemaker, who's the czarina, the head of the Parks and Rec Department, has been confirmed that this is our absurd and legally ludicrous policy of destroying homeless property, and in despite of what state law is and the federal decisions have been, primarily because, I don't know, maybe the city attorney thinks he's going to make money himself arguing these cases. He and his wife, who argue for the city, John Barasoni and his wife, are happy to argue these cases. They get paid additional amounts of money for these kinds of arguments and these kinds of cases. And there is no competitive process in determining the city attorney of Santa Cruz. So we don't have any real review of what they do. We just have a bunch of compliant city council members who line up like dominoes in a row and vote for what the police chief and the city manager for life, Dick Wilson, and the heads of these departments want. Dinette Shoemaker, who made it illegal to smoke in the parks through an edict about a year and a half ago, at least in the San Lorenzo Park and I think the Grant Street Park. And the reason this is so absurd, as been pointed out by commentator and bloggist Becky Johnson, is obviously San Lorenzo Park is a huge place. I mean, you would set aside some area for smokers. I mean, why not? And people who don't want to smoke can avoid that area. And the smokers will have to avoid all other areas while they're smoking. And that would be, you know, kind of a reasonable compromise. But there are no reasonable compromises around this as far as the prohibitionists go, both for smoking and, I guess, for other things. And this is going to come up on Saturday. If anybody wants to do any cop watching at the Wham Fest, do give me a call, 423-4833, 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF is my number off air, and we can talk about it. I'd like to be supportive of that. Also, if you want to talk about this issue on air, you can call right now, 427-3772. That's the on-air number here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 427-3772. Yeah, here's the article in the Sentinel. Santa Cruz rejects compromise on park smoking for medical marijuana festival. It's by Genevieve Bookwalter, as usual, her reporting is about as deep as the shallowest creek around, or as, you know, a fetid washroom, I don't know. She just doesn't go very deep. City police officers could be in the uncomfortable position of picketing ill marijuana medical patients, medical marijuana patients on Saturday if leaders of the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana try to allow patients to inhale at their annual festival. Actually, it's whether patients decide they're going to inhale because they need to, because it's their right to, because it hurts nobody else there, but because we have this prohibitionist kind of darkness sweeping the city as well as the rest of the state and retaining in the country. You've heard, you know, those illusions that Obama is going to stop prosecutions and, you know, be more reasonable in marijuana, at least medical marijuana. It ain't happening, folks. At least it's not happening in any concerted and consistent way. And that's been talked about. If you want more information, go to safeaccess.org and look up their website. You'll get more information about that. Valerie Corral, this story continues from the Sentinel. Co-founder of WHAM, a nonprofit collection for seriously ill medical marijuana patients, told council members Tuesday that patients needed a spot to smoke if necessary at Saturday's celebration of medical marijuana. She said the group would erect tents near the sidewalk for patients with prescriptions to smoke privately during the annual celebration. Smoking of all sorts is banned in the park and is allowed on the sidewalk until the Santa Cruz's new no-smoking rules take effect next month. The city leaders, though, near the sidewalk is still in the park. As a result, those caught breaking the smoking ban could be cited $70. And actually, it's not $70. It's $70 plus court costs, which probably makes it about $200 to $300. Although, yeah, that's what I think it probably is. I haven't looked up the law, but that's my general sense of it. Of course, it's awkward, said Councilmember Mike Rotkin, a longtime WHAM supporter and endless council hypocrite. I'll be talking about that in a moment. Both WHAM and probably most of the council members, if not all of them, would rather that it not end up this way. This is messy, says Mike Rotkin. The situation arose, according to Genevieve, from a procedural foul-up that precluded WHAM from asking the city council to lift the no-smoking ban so the group could hold its annual medical marijuana celebration in San Lorenzo Park as in years past. On Tuesday, Corral took responsibility for not asking a city council member to sponsor the item for consideration on that day's agenda as required under city rules. I apologize for the kerfuffle that came about. That's come about, Corral said. Her solution, tents near the sidewalk, was not an acceptable compromise for council members. While I understand that need, there is a risk of citation, Councilwoman Lynn Robinson. Can't somebody do something about her? Said, impeach her, recall her. I don't know what to say about her. Santa Cruz police spokesman Zach Friend, there's another guy that, an amiable propagandist, reiterated previous statements that the department will not increase the number of officers on duty for WHAM Fest, but those working will give tickets to people caught smoking in the park. The city also could fine WHAM for violating its use permit for the event. It is our desire that WHAM will take ownership of the fact that an exemption was not granted and encourage attendees to respect the ordinance. So if you're sick and feel real bad, tough. Either don't exercise your First Amendment rights or just get sicker and sicker as you do. Friend said, if attendees elect to flaunt the ordinance, we are more than willing to issue citations. Thank you, Zach Friend. Corral said people are missing the point that those who will be smoking are seriously ill and use marijuana to relieve their symptoms. She said the smoking will continue, but WHAM will ensure it is discreet. We're losing track of what's important here, Corral said. You almost wouldn't know this is all about people who are sick. Now, a couple things are missing from this story, which Genevieve Bookwalter should know and probably does know, although I haven't talked to her about this, and naturally she hasn't talked to me. Mike Rotkin, or any member of the city council, could have introduced at that council session an emergency ordinance just right off the bat, without any notice whatsoever. That would, however, have required that 5 members of the council out of 7 vote for it. And I think if there were only 4 council members there, and I think there were only 4, maybe that means a majority of 3 would have voted for it, or maybe not. So I'm just realizing as I talk now that I was told that there are only 4 council members present, at least At the time, the no-smoking law got its second successful reading in the afternoon. Now, I don't know how many, if that was the case throughout the day and in the evening, and I suspect I'll have to look that up. But if there were six or seven members present for sure, I'm pretty sure, even five, I'm suggesting that what's called an emergency ordinance could have been brought forward. And an emergency ordinance is one that, A, requires a higher vote, as I said before, five out of seven, or something to that effect, maybe six, five out of seven or five out of six, or maybe four out of five, but certainly five out of seven will pass an emergency ordinance. And they also have to present some kind of emergency findings. You say, well, what's the emergency with Wham if Valerie Correll fucked up with this? Well, the emergency is a medical emergency. These are people who are ill. These are people who are actually at the Wham Fest in order to raise money for their organization, which we've heard at different points is in trouble. And, you know, I'm sympathetic to that. I'd like to see them continue to be supported, although I have bad, you know, criticisms of Wham for other reasons as well. But nonetheless, so there could be an emergency declaration made. You might say, wasn't that a serious matter? I mean, you know, maybe that requires more of an emergency than exists. Well, to give you an example of the kind of thing Mike Rotkin considers an emergency, back in 2003, when Tom Noddy, who's the famous world-famous bubble blower and Santa Cruz resident who spends a lot of time in Germany and overseas with his act, but also is involved with the Street Performers Guild and created the Street Performers Guidelines and has been active in organizing and being a spokesperson at different points for street performers, was informed by the city attorney and the city manager group that juggling was illegal in Santa Cruz under the new Rotkin-Matthews ordinances, which maybe we should call them the Riley-Porter ordinances, because they actually, the initial version of them passed in the summer before Rotkin and Matthews were reelected, but they voted in finalized guidelines, and so I think they reaffirmed them in January of 2003 after they've been elected in 2002, supposedly supposedly not criminalizing or allowing juggling to happen on Pacific Avenue. However, police, as they do these days, began expanding their jurisdiction and their sense of what is appropriate on Pacific Avenue and began arresting people or citing people for juggling. So Tom Noddy went to, you know, the legal route, asked the council members what was going on, asked the city manager what was going on, talked to the city attorney. Finally, he was told that it was their opinion that juggling was illegal in spite of the wording of the ordinance. So he said, okay, that's fine. We'll call a juggling festival into Santa Cruz. And he put out a call to the Flying Karamazov brothers and other groups to come to town and do some juggling. The minute that Rotkin heard about this, he introduced an emergency ordinance that would legalize juggling. And that passed under his leadership unanimously in the summer of 2003. I think it was unanimous. I don't recall there were any dissenters. So if juggling is an emergency for Rotkin, then surely the right of medical marijuana patients, seriously ill medical marijuana patients, are the people that Wham really pays a lot of attention to and consists of in the main, as I understand it, as I'm told anyway, that's an even bigger emergency. But no, not apparently enough for Councilmember Rotkin, unless I'm wrong, unless there's some special provision that requires there to be more council members present, but I don't think so. I think that you can pass an emergency ordinance with a smaller number of council members present, provided you have a quorum, but you just need to have two-thirds majority of those voting. And I've got to look up the actual specific wording of the law to be sure about that, but that's my understanding. So that's why I call Rotkin a hypocrite. He essentially cooks up these exalted excuses with a very amiable disposition about what he's doing, at the same time as he essentially follows his own agenda, which is very conservative, pro-police, often anti-union, pro-developer, and certainly anti-homeless civil rights in the city council. And he needs particular mention not because he's a bad human being, but because his politics are bad, and he'll be mayor in November. We don't get to vote on him. The city council will vote on him. He's right now he's vice mayor, and traditionally that's what happens. We have a caller. Perhaps Big Mike is calling in. you're on Free Radio. What's your name, caller?
My name is Micah.
Hey, Micah. You're not Mike. I was hoping Mike Rotkin was going to call in.
Oh, yeah? That would be cool with the update from the rally and the strike.
Yeah, that's actually true. On that side of things, there's been, of course, a walkout on campus today?
Yeah, absolutely. They used our little bike generator to do announcements.
You are with People Power, of course.
I'm with People Power, that's right.
And you were up on the campus today checking
out? I was, and I meant to get up there, and I didn't make it.
Oh, you didn't get up there?
No, someone else from People Power brought up the bike generator.
Oh, dear. But perhaps maybe we can get somebody to call in. I'm wondering if we have anybody listening who is up there on campus. Please call in. 427-3772. But anyway, what's up, Micah? You have an announcement, I believe.
Yeah, I'd like to tell everyone who's listening to Free Radio about something we're doing on Sunday. We're having a rail cleanup all along the rail line. And the reason we're doing it is because it looks like by the end of the year, the county will make a decision on whether or not to buy the rail line. We hope they do. If they buy the rail line, they intend to put in a bicycle and walking trail and ultimately a train. So in order to express how much we want them to do that and to show that we're willing to be responsible for the rail line, we're having a rail cleanup.
So how do people get involved with this?
Thanks. It's 1 o'clock on Sunday, and we're meeting near the trestle over the San Lorenzo River, just on the east side of the trestle. So if you're at the boardwalk, walk over the trestle, and we're meeting right there.
Okay, and if people want more information, is there like an announcement on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz?
I don't know. There's stuff on our website, peoplepowersc.org.
Peoplepowersc.org?
Yeah.
Okay.
For your listeners, I thought it might be fun for them to realize that the county doesn't own the corridor yet. So, in a way, it's like, you know, making corporate property public. I mean, in a nice way, but we're basically telling Union Pacific, like, hey, look, this is already basically public property. Just take the money and leave us alone.
For sure. Any, I know you had a rally and a bike ride to open up King Street and to find alternatives to Mission Street, but at least to defend the rights of bicyclists who need to use Mission Street. Have there been any fallout from that? I know last time you did this, way back in last year, you got a ticket for it, which I understand you're still scoffing at.
Yeah, no tickets so far. And last time I got the ticket within 2 weeks. This time it's been 5 or 6 weeks. This time there was a lot of talk with the city ahead of time. There were council members that we involved, particularly Don Lane, and no promises were made to us that we wouldn't get a ticket. In fact, they threatened me that we'd get a ticket, but we respectfully stood up to them, did the right anyways, and so far no tickets.
Well, aren't you a criminal, man? I don't want to even talk to guys like you on the air.
Well, I am not a criminal.
Wow.
I am a bicyclist.
You are a bicyclist.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's going to be 1 o'clock on Sunday to do a rail trail cleanup.
Yeah, bring closed-toed shoes, and we're going to have all kinds of gloves and stuff, but if people have gloves and garbage bags, they go ahead and bring them. That'd be great.
Sounds good to me, man.
Okay, see you there.
All right. Well, no, you won't see me there. I'll be here in the studio, but I'll mention it. In fact, I suggest you call again and again on Sunday to
When does the show start?
Starts at 9:30, goes to 1.
Okay, we'll see right afterwards.
No,
we have you booked. Okay, take care.
All right, man.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And you can always call in if you got comments at 427-3772. And there's some interesting links on the Santa Cruz Sentinel website on this issue, Genevieve's story on the Wham Fest turndown. Boy, I wish I could be there. I'm going to be occupied on Saturday doing something else, but maybe somebody else will be. I'm sure they'll be there with video cameras keeping an eye on every little ticket the police decided to, you know, give to seriously ill patients because of their smoking marijuana, even though there have been no complaints about it, just because the city wishes to show its authority in that regard. And there's some discussion online about it. We have some folks saying, well, you know, I favor medical marijuana, but tough luck for them here because Valerie didn't come in early enough, Valerie Corral, and make a compromise proposal. I've always said that there should be no compromise. Medical marijuana patients should be allowed to smoke, at least in the same places tobacco smokers smoke, 365 days a year. for health purposes, if nothing else. I think for recreational purposes, too, since medical marijuana itself, smoking anything is, you know, has a toxic element to it, and secondhand smoke has a toxic element to it, too, according to various studies. And even toxic smoking outside, according to one study which Don Lane, council member, sent me, claims that there is toxic particulates in secondhand smoke outside that linger. Again, there haven't apparently been many studies done on this, but cities are racing to criminalize, and I've talked about my feelings on the smoking ban and how it's really something that I think should be between individuals. People should speak up and say, you know, I've got asthma, can you put out your cigarette? Not, see, no smoking sign, no smoking sign, that sort of thing. I'll call the police. I'll write you a ticket. That's apparently the wave of the future. Anyway, so there's some interesting commentary online about this, and it was one of the two things, actually one of the three things that I was going to cover at City Council, and I may actually be talking more about on Sunday when I have a longer show, as I mentioned before, from 9:30 to 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Today is October 24th. I'm looking at one of my old Autonomedia calendars, and I see that's the birthday of Molly Brandt, or at least they're celebrating her on that date. She was a Mohawk political leader who supported the British against the American colonists, or colonialists, during the Revolutionary War. Interesting. She secretly aided her brother Joseph Brant's Iroquois forces against the Americans in the Mohawk Valley. She informed on American troop movements, sent ammunition, fed and assisted those who had taken refuge in the woods. Forced by the Americans to leave her home, she moved further west. She used her considerable influence among the Six Nations to keep the Cayugas and the Senecas on the British side. And it's interesting, the British, I'm no fan of British imperialism, mind you, but the British were actually moving towards abolishing slavery. They didn't actually abolish it until the 1830s formally, but there already was a case of a slave who was freed because when he got to England, once you were in England, he claimed he had the right to be free because he was in England. And he won that court case in 1772. One of the reasons that, they don't talk about it in the history books, but that's one of the reasons that Southerners were so eager to declare independence. They were afraid the British were going to apply the decision in the colonies of freeing slaves. They actually don't think, it's not too clear that was how realistic a fear that was. But the British, you know, they would offer blacks freedom. They would offer them incentives as well as Indians in order to turn against American rebels. And the Molly Brandt is an example of one woman who stood on the side of the Native Americans, for better or for worse. October 24th is also got a couple other dates. This is the date that the American colonial reformer William Penn was born. And I've learned some interesting things about Pennsylvania from the audio tape, assuming it's accurate, that I've played to on a couple of shows, parts of this book, 25 Lessons in Nonviolence, by, I think his name is Mark Kurlansky. Pennsylvania was about the only colony where they refused to provide draftees for the British wars throughout the late 1600s and early 1700s. The Quakers controlled the legislature. And there was a kind of a conflict that developed between people in western Pennsylvania who were kind of fighting Indians and taking more territory, and Indians who were fighting back to keep their land, and those in eastern Pennsylvania who are more well-to-do and therefore could afford to have more principles, perhaps, about nonviolence, who actually made agreements with the Indians instead of, you know, mandating wipeout policies. Although I think at numerous points in American history, the U.S. government made agreements with the Indians, which didn't appear to be wipeout policies, but actually ended up being just that. In 1901, Anna Taylor was the first to survive going over Niagara Falls in a barrel. Not the first woman to survive, apparently, but the first person to survive. I was never aware of that, but that's what this calendar says. We'll have to see about that. And in 1940, the so-called 40-hour work week was established in the U.S. at this date. And it's also on the 24th, Alexandra David Neal, first Western woman explorer of Tibet and its mysteries, was born. This is also United Nations Day, apparently, or at least it was back in 2003, which I'm looking at an old calendar here and just sort of passing on some archaic names. History books too often cover people too many times who actually did bad things, whether it's Christopher Columbus or Kit Carson or, I don't know, John F. Kennedy, you name it. A bunch of essentially people whose actions result from the deaths of many people and who are celebrated, almost it seems ironically for that, and we don't get the other side, the people that we don't hear about. New York State, this is American Indian Day. Oh, dear, I see, I was looking at the October calendar. My apologies. Well, don't put those dates I just gave you ahead to October 24th. September 24th here does have Dr. Seuss's birthday, so let's not forget that. And also yesterday was Victoria Woodhull's birthday. Victoria Clifton Woodhull, she's one of my heroes. She was a proponent of free love. She was a spiritualist and spiritual teacher. She was the first woman to run for the U.S. presidency with Frederick Douglass in 1872. She was the first, one of the first women stockbrokers. She was a member of the First Socialist and Communist International until she was expelled by Marx. Victoria Clifton Woodhull. So, it's Free Radio you're listening to. I'm Robert Norse, and let's take a little musical break. I'll be right back, and I'll try to get on the line Doug Loisel, the Homeless Services Center director. We can talk to him about a few issues, such as the new 50-cent meal charge that has been reimposed. You want to eat food out there, you got to cough up your two quarters. And there have been some positive changes, apparently. He's also opened up the Homeless Service Center area, or campus, as he calls it. I always rib him about that. If it's a campus, where are the books? Where are the sports facilities? Where's the canteen? Ain't there. But it used to be closed during the day unless you were getting your mail or being there for a very short period to go to your storage locker or whatever. He has apparently opened it up during the day, and he has, wonder of wonders, opened up, he says, I haven't checked this out, but I take him at his word, 24-hour bathrooms, so that even if you're not using the facilities, even if it's closed to hanging out, closed to sleeping, closed to shelter, which a lot of people need but isn't available, and you can get sleeping tickets if you sleep outside, still, you can go in, maybe you can catch a quick snooze on the can before you rush out at 3 in the morning. I don't know, not advising people to use the bathroom as a shelter, mind you, but I'm glad that there is a bathroom opened up, a 24-hour bathroom opened up at night. That may be the only 24-hour bathroom in town, unless you're a customer and they let you into, Denny's or Santa Cruz Diner. Here's a little music.
I don't care if it rains or freezes, long as I've got my plastic Jesus riding on the dashboard of my car. Through my trials and tribulations and my travels through the nation, with my plastic Jesus I'll go far. Plastic Jesus, plastic Jesus, riding on the dashboard of my car. I'm afraid he'll have to go. His magnets ruin my radio, and if I have a wreck, he'll leave a scar.
Riding down a thoroughfare with his nose up in the air, a wreck may be ahead, but he don't mind. Trouble coming, he don't see, 'cause he's just got his eye on me and any other thing that lies behind.
plastic Jesus, plastic Jesus, riding on the dashboard of my car.
Though the sunshine on his back makes him peel and chip and crack, a little patch and keeps him up the car.
When pedestrians try to cross, I let them know whose false sign. Never blow the horn or give them warning. I ride all over town trying to run them down. It's seldom that they live to see the morning. Plastic Jesus, plastic Jesus, riding on the dashboard of my car. His halo fits just right. I use it for a sight. They'll scatter or they'll splatter near and far. Traffic jam, he don't care if I say damn. I can let all sorts of curses go. Plastic Jesus doesn't hear, for he has a plastic ear. The man who invented plastic saved my soul. Plastic Jesus, plastic Jesus, riding on the dashboard of my car. Once his robe was snowy white, now it isn't quite so bright, stained by the smoke of my cigar. If I weave around at night and the police think I'm tight, they'll never find my bottle, oh, they ask. Plastic Jesus shelters me, for his head comes up, you see, he's hollow, and I use him for a flask. Plastic Jesus, plastic Jesus, riding on the dashboard of my car. Ride with me and have a dram, all the blood of the lamb, plastic Jesus is a holy ball.
I don't care if it rains or freezes, long as I got my plastic Jesus riding on the dashboard of my car. Through my trials and tribulations and my travels through the nations, with my plastic Jesus I'll go far.
Plastic Jesus, plastic Jesus, riding on the dashboard of my car.
But I'm afraid he'll have to go, his magnets ruin my radio, and if I have a wreck he'll leave a scar.
And that, of course, was Plastic Jesus by Ernie Mars and the Mars Family. Again, way back in the 60s, one of the most hotly debated songs ever printed in Broadside Magazine, earlier published in Sing Out. Its publication led to a barrage of angry letters from subscribers asking, how can you publish something so blasphemous? People canceled subscriptions, claimed they would never read the magazine again. As the publications in Sing Out, articles were written fiercely defending the song. Gordon Friesen replied, isn't the song sacrilegious? We ask in turn, where does the sacrilege lie, really, with the song or those greedy for profits who debase the Savior by producing and peddling these cheap little trinkets made in his image? I don't know. Indeed, the song still provokes outrage from those who fail to realize that its target is the purveyors of religious kitsch, not religion itself, whereas I, of course, would be attacking religion itself, at least insofar as the organized religion describes the dictates of Christianity in terms of the military requirements and the sexual restrictions and so forth. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org, and my name is Robert Norris. And as promised, I'm about to give a call to assuming I can find a proper number. I'm having a little problem with my computer, though. I think we're okay here. Let's see if I can get a hold of our man. We'll give him a call. And let's see. So we're ringing that man now.
Excuse me, hello?
Hello, is this the infamous Doug Loisel?
Listen, would be, and you pronounced my name right. Thank you.
Ah, well, I'm working on it. You know, it takes a while. You're not Loisielli or Loisel, but Loisel. And you are, in fact, for what, 6-7 months now, the director of the Homeless Service Center in Santa Cruz?
Yeah, about 7 months now.
And I know that you gave me a call this afternoon, and you were concerned about some issues. You also wanted to kind of give me an update, which is rare. I probably you're the only Homeless Service Center director who's ever done this, and of course you will be eternally disgraced for doing this. But and you know, particularly since we don't agree, we don't see eye to eye on all things, right?
That's true. That's true. In particular, the fact that we're charging 50 cents for a meal now.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. I know that that began, what, in early August? Is that right?
Early August. That's correct.
And then you suspended it because somebody put in a donation saying, well, I'll pay for it?
Well, actually, several people put in donations. And so what we did was we suspended it, and then we paid for all the meals for the clients with the donated money. And then when we ran out, we went back to charging the clients for meals again.
And when did that charge, when was it renewed?
Oh, I'd say probably about 3 weeks ago or so.
So you probably get a pretty good idea of whether the charge has actually reduced the eating population.
I'm sorry, say that again?
How has the charge, the 50-cent charge for breakfast and dinner, reduced the number of people eating?
Well, it actually depends on what time of the month. When we rolled it out in early August, there was a 75% reduction in meals at the beginning of the month. And that's, we think it's mostly because the clients were getting their benefits checks, any government benefits they were entitled to. They get that at the beginning of the month. And so then, you know, of course, they'd rather eat elsewhere. And then towards the end of the month, we saw this gradual increase in clients until we got up to our more regular numbers.
So, but if you were saying, you probably don't, I don't know if you have stats, but were you able to compare it with, let's say, the decrease in people around the beginning of July when there was no charge, but there still were these government checks coming in?
Yeah, we didn't do any comparison between, say, August and July, but we will. We always see a reduction in clients at the beginning of the month, always more at the end of the month. But no, we didn't do any analysis of that.
Do you have any sense of whether there is a general reduction independently of whether there is, you know, whether the time of month because there are checks coming in or not coming in, but because of the fact that it costs 50 cents?
I don't know. I don't believe so. I think our clients, I think initially maybe there was some resentment towards the administration for imposing this 50-cent, you know, charge. And I think that's kind of mellowed out a little bit. And so now we're getting back to more of our normal numbers despite the 50 cents.
So you think maybe people just resented the idea and stayed away for that reason alone, not because their budget required them to?
Oh, yeah. I was told to my face on several different occasions, many things related to people's feelings of resentment towards the 50-cent charge. Many expletives were directed in my direction as I was out talking with the clients on the campus.
Hmm.
So some of it, you know, is good natured, and some people were really upset, but...
You also had a procedure whereby people could work for 45 minutes at what amounted to 66 cents an hour kind of labor to, if they couldn't afford it, they could work for 45 minutes, something like that?
Well, actually, if you look at the actual cost of the meal, it's probably a lot higher hourly rate because the actual cost of the meal is much more than 50 cents. Probably if you roll everything in, to it's well over $2. So your calculation's probably not 100% accurate. But, we have people, and normally it's actually about a half an hour. It's not 45 minutes. And we have, it's only persons who are able to help us out on the campus. It's not persons who, you know, have what's the word I'm looking for, motility issues or any type of disabilities. It's only the people that, you know, can assist us around the campus, basically just, you know, kind of cleaning up, sweeping up, and those sorts of things. Our average on the list is 14 people.
Who can't pay?
Who can't or won't pay.
And are they all working, or some of them get a pass because of their motility or their disability problems?
So some get in on you know, just the fact that they're not able to work. We've actually and then there's some people that don't pay for the meal, eat the meal and eat. So that's another issue.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Some people show up. They don't pay for the meal. They eat the meal, and then they don't stick around to do any type of community service.
Dine and dash.
Dine and dash.
But
yeah.
You don't call the police and have them hauled off to the Hooskow.
No, we have a three strikes policy. Whereas, you know, if you do that three times, then we have a discussion with you and find out what the issues are.
Now, I understand the food is donated. You don't have to buy it. Is that accurate?
Partially. We get a lot of food donated from Second Harvest Food Bank. We get a lot of food by Trader Joe's. New Life has started to donate food to us, but we purchase about $50,000 worth of food a year.
And just
because, you know, you can't, you know, you've got all this food come in, but you have to put it all together. So you think, you know, you need things like salad dressing and, spices and, all those sorts of things that don't come in these kind of bulk Second Harvest Food Bank, fruit and vegetable donations.
So 50,000 is what percentage or what you would say is the total, what would be the total cost of the food if you paid for it all?
I would say that $50,000 is probably about 33% of the total cost. Is that what you're asking?
It sounds like your $50,000 is only covering incidental items like salad dressing and not substantial items like the actual salads themselves or the main courses or the bulk food.
some of it is bulk food, depending on, we're at the mercy of what they donate to us. If there's deficits in certain bulk items, then we have to purchase the bulk items. So we work with, we get our food through, I believe, Sysco. So we are buying kind of bulk items as well as things like salad dressing and croutons and all the other stuff that goes into it.
Now, in the 7 months you've been executive director of the Homeless Service Center, we're talking with Doug Loisel, who's en route to Los Angeles, I guess, as we speak, right?
That's correct.
And actually, you kind of do a commute. Your family lives down there, and you're up here, but you also have a home up here, right?
I don't know if you call a fifth-wheel trailer a home.
For homeless people, it's certainly a home, no question.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's great. I live up in Bonny Doon, so it's really quite beautiful. And then I have a home Southern California with my family.
Now, in the 7 months you've been Homeless Service Center director, the recession hasn't gotten any better. Has that had any consequences on the number of people coming for meals?
The recession.
Pardon me. The depression hasn't gotten any nicer.
Yeah. The recession probably hasn't had that a significant impact on the number of persons that we serve. I think that the majority of people that we serve at Homeless Service Center, generally speaking, are longtime Santa Cruz residents. They're known to the campus. They've been seeking services there for years. So our population has been not too much affected by the recession. Our waiting lists are a little bit longer, and we're seeing more first-time homeless persons, which I have a feeling we're going to see a spike in people we serve been a little bit further down the line. Because, you know, for example, if you're a guy and you have a house and you can't pay your mortgage, it takes a while for it to go to foreclosure. Then you go and spend time with friends. And then after you're done couch surfing with friends, maybe a family member. But then all this stuff gets worn out, and a year down the line, you're out of resources. And so that's what I think we're going to see, maybe a little delayed response from the recession in relation to the numbers that we serve.
Now, I know there have been kind of this annual or biannual census that's come out, and there are organizations that, I don't know, whether they feed on this by understating the figures or overstating the figures, but how many homeless people would you estimate? I'm sure there's a question you've been asked repeatedly. I know I have. Would you say there are in Santa Cruz City at any one time? I'm not saying the county. I'm saying the city, since you are in the city limits, and a lot of your clients are from, most of your clients, I would imagine, are from the city, right?
Yeah, I believe so. What count do you come up with, or what's your estimate?
You know, I mean, I keep using the same number, but I often wonder how accurate it is. I used to say 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 750 to 1,500. Now I say 1,500 to 2,000, but the last count I heard, I've heard actually count since then, but there was a 1,300 count in 2,000 at one point in time, and I, you know, since that counters couldn't get the peak, obviously, I don't think they could consider getting all the people, particularly because there are concerns that the counters are followed by the police and John Wallace's Parks and Rec Rangers who then come in and break up the camps. I don't know. This has been claimed. I haven't got a lot of documentation that this happens, you know, thoroughly or regularly, but it certainly has happened a little. I've heard that. So, yeah, my estimate is 1,500 to 2,000, but, you know, I'm asking you because I thought you might have some more. You have some figures, certainly, about the number of people who use the homeless service center, and that, of course, is only a fraction of the homeless population, right?
Yeah. I don't have any more information than you have. What I think happens is that the more the chronic shelterless person get counted, right, the people who are chronically homeless, I think what the person don't get counted on that are the people who are traveling through, the travelers, which may or not be sheltered. So I think that you have this basic homeless population that probably is between 1,500 and 2,000, but then you probably have another 500 plus that are just traveling through at one time or another during the year, maybe 1,000, I don't know. But I think that other population is not counted, for whatever reason. They may not be in the area that the longer term homeless persons are in. I don't know, but I just get the sense that, especially in the summer months, the census goes up a lot.
Recently, we've had some differences of opinion, not just around the food issue, paying for 50 cents for a meal. I know that the people who I serve food with, people went to jail for it to establish essentially the services that you have 20 years ago. A lot of us did. We would have never thought in a million years of charging any money for food, nor did even Karen Gillette, who did a free meal with Brian Koepke and then ran the Homeless Community Resource Center until 1998. Nor, I guess, would Ken Cole, although maybe it was proposed during his time. So you've adopted a new procedure. Are there any other taxes, so to speak, that you've imposed on the homeless community or changes? I know that we had a disagreement about, you suggested that the streets near the homeless community center be ruled out of, given two-hour parking limits because of complaints by nearby businesses about untoward behavior, like, I don't know, bringing out a barbecue or seeing people smoking marijuana or, I don't know, when the homeless service center didn't have an open bathroom, taking a dump or taking a piss, which I think, to your credit, you finally addressed here, you know, with this 24-hour bathroom thing, which, congratulations, that's long overdue. But are there other areas where you are attempting to, considering either imposing fees or already have imposed fees?
I don't believe so. I can't think of any off the top of my head.
How about paid toilets? Now there's an idea.
No. We want to give as much as we can away free. We don't want to burden anybody with a bunch of extra costs. We want people to hopefully use their money in a productive, positive way and to find their way out of the homeless condition. That would be our goal. But no, we don't have any thoughts of any other types of charges on the campus.
Now, I don't know if you probably been aware of some of the controversies that I've been involved in. In fact, you actually made it down to a protest to sort of see what was going on in front of Bunny's Shoes, where we're concerned about the new legal tool being used against at least two homeless street performers, Anna Richardson and Miguel De Leon, who now have an injunction against them that they fall asleep at all on any occasion after 11 o'clock at night in downtown Santa Cruz or nearby in the San Lorenzo Park. They will face jail, although that has not been imposed, and I think the police have actually been holding off when it happened. They don't get cited, although where it's illegal everywhere in town anyway, but there's been a step up both in police enforcement downtown, it feels to me, mostly for sitting near a building, performing in the wrong place. There's been an expansion of the forbidden zones through the legislation by the city council, pushed by the Downtown Business Association and the Chamber of Commerce in January and February, making it illegal to sit on a bench for more than an hour downtown. Have you any reaction to these laws, which the city council members, notably Don Lane or Gon Lame, as I like to call him, claim are not anti-homeless in the least, that they're simply behavioral rules so that we will all conduct ourselves properly downtown and have no disproportionate influence on poor people?
Is that a question?
That's a speech.
Or just you're wondering about my opinion?
Yes.
Okay. Well, first of all, we opened up the HSC campus during the day so that anybody who's homeless or otherwise is free to come onto the campus and do what they feel like they'd like to do. There's a couple of things. We don't want dogs on the campus for a number of different reasons. That could be problematic. We don't like people to come and park their car and sit all day. But if people want to come up we have an awning, they can sit under that, they can play games, they can sleep if they want to. You know, we don't care if they come over and just sleep. Because it really is kind of a pinch for, I think, a lot of people. What is a homeless person doing during the day? I know a lot of people go to the library. I know, clients will go to Borders or Starbucks or hang out downtown, and we just want to give people an option if they want to be somewhere that's, well, I would hope, relatively hassle-free, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's one thing that came out of this, maybe some of the ordinances that are going on downtown. I think also you have to add to that, well, I don't know, I don't think the smoking issue has to do with the homeless population. I think it more has to do with, I think, following what other cities have done in relation to, outdoor smoking.
Well, a few other cities, very few, relatively. It's not like we're, a great majority of the cities have done what Santa Cruz is doing.
Okay, I didn't know that. I don't know.
I mean, that's my impression. They don't say every city in California or nine or two-thirds. They say the following five cities have done this, and then that they're... they're trying to be a bellwether. They don't want to be the city that, let's say, researches and disassociates itself from companies that, let's say, war profiteer in Afghanistan and Iraq. No, they're not interested in that. But they will ban smoking, which I continue to believe disproportionately affects homeless people. I mean, have you done any research on how many homeless people smoke and how this impacts them? I mean, ordinary people can withdraw into their homes. Housed people can withdraw into their homes. Homeless people... If Ranger Wallace catches them up on the tracks lighting up a cigarette, you know, or in a park or in the Poganip where, I mean, you don't allow smoking in the homeless service center, do you?
Well, we have a smoking area.
Oh, well, that has, might propose that to the city council. That might be a good idea, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we did have smoking when I arrived there. People could smoke anywhere on the campus, but state law says that you can't smoke, I believe it's 25 feet or 20 feet within an area of business. And basically that kind of like made this swath down the middle of our driveway. And so we just said, look, we're just going to set up the smoking area over here. And if you wouldn't mind, could you kindly smoke over there? So,
what's your impression about the percentage of homeless people who smoke?
It's high. You know, it's really high. I would say probably over 50%.
So why wouldn't you then tell the city council members, you know, your buddy Don Lane, I don't know if he's your buddy or not, but he shows up as some sort of, you know, homeless advocate. He's been on the board at different times of your board. Why wouldn't you point out to him and to the city council that this will disproportionately impact homeless people? I mean, it might be good. You know, you might force them to give up nicotine, or you simply might, you know, drive people into greater distraction unless you're providing other resources.
Well, first of all, Don Lane is my buddy, so...
Well, I'm glad you're candid about that.
He's my good friend. I want to be clear on that. And he is an advocate for the homeless, at least I think he is.
I don't think the H word appeared at all during the smoking discussion, as Mr. Advocate voted unanimously for that and for every other anti-homeless activity by the city council in the last 8 months. I mean, so if he's an advocate, I don't know what kind of company you're keeping, but go ahead.
Yeah, you were kind of cutting out a little bit there, but I think, you know, Don would like to see our services expanded. Don would like to see, I'm speaking for Don now, and I think that he wants people to have access to services that will help them to have a higher quality of life, and I think that's always been his
I think you're beginning to cut out. Can you still hear me? Maybe not. Doug? 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 Oh, dear. Yeah, it sounds like we've lost him. Maybe he will try to call us back, or we can try to call. That was Doug Loisel of the Homeless Service Center. I'm going to try to reach him again on Sunday during our longer show and talk to him about some other matters, violence downtown, that some concerns about how police are interacting with homeless people, and some other issues that have come up. I mean, I got to say, I'm both really impressed with Doug's willingness to be open about these issues, his accessibility, and there he is. That's probably him again. Free radio here.
Hey, Ross. Doug again.
Yeah, you know, if you get cut out, I think we can try again on Sunday, if you happen to be up for another, you know, kind of a chapter two. But
sure.
I was just praising you as being accessible and, you know, interested at least in what some advocates think about things. And also, you know, you called me today on another issue, which we haven't yet brought up, which has to do with concerns about violence against the homeless.
Oh, yeah. I was just wondering, you know, what your take is on it at present, because we had a client who had an altercation with two police officers, and he was in pretty bad shape. So, I had called you earlier to find out, you know, what your opinion of things are related to that. I don't know the particulars, other than what the client conveyed to me, but he was very upset. So,
yeah, I haven't. You know, I mean, I'm hoping that I can talk to this man, assuming it's a man.
It is a man.
And you know, I got to say that generally, the violence I've been hearing about against homeless people has come from what I call troll busters, what other witnesses have called East Side thugs. Although I'm not quite sure why they think they're from the East Side necessarily. who have come down to New Leaf last week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday nights, to intimidate, verbally abuse, and then actually physically attack some homeless people. And, you know, the homeless people they attacked are not, some of them are not even willing to go on tape. Others are willing to go on tape but are not willing to have that tape broadcast at this time because they're, their assailants are still there. They're still using homeless services. One of them saw the assailant at the homeless, the Monday meal at the Red Church, which happens every Monday. I guess that's where we actually had a long conversation about 2 or 3 months ago, Doug.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
I ran into you there. That's the Calvary Episcopal Church across from Jack's Hamburgers and the Farmer's Market. For those who want to get actually involve themselves in homeless activity, you can always, I suppose, check out your homeless service center. You're looking for volunteers there, I imagine, too, right?
Yeah, we have a volunteer coordinator, and we're always looking for volunteers to come in, and there's a whole range of things that people can do. And then, you know, we like, of course, you know, monetary donations, but just as much as monetary donations, it's great when people in the community get involved. So, we use a significant amount of volunteers.
What kind of wages do you pay your staff?
I would say significantly under nonprofit standards. There's a resource book. It's done by the Center for Nonprofit Management, and it gives salary. It's a whole salary survey of nonprofits. They do one in Northern California and Southern California. We're well below the 25th percentile in most categories.
What is that kind of? What does that amount to? Like we're talking $6 an hour, $8 an hour, $20 an hour?
You know, line staff, who would be our monitors, our lot managers, our monitors on the lot, the night monitors, generally make between probably about $8 and $10 an hour. And then if you move up into more of a management or a coordinator position, then you're going to make probably 15 plus, maybe 14, 13 to 15 or $16 an hour. And then our directors make anywhere from about $48,000 to my salary, which is $76,000.
Which is actually less than the average police officer, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Although maybe it's slightly more than the lowest grade of police officer. I'm not sure. We're talking with Doug Loisel, Homeless Service Center Director. Doug, you one of the principal concerns. I should probably give you some more time to talk about this client who apparently had a physical altercation with the police, and I'm going to be talking to him directly. Hopefully, if he gets in touch with me. Is this happened? Is this a rare occurrence? Is this the first time this has happened to you, or is
I've never seen anything like that. I've not heard or seen anything similar to this situation.
So you haven't had a lot of people coming up to you and saying the police beat me up last night?
No, not at all.
But this was an occasion when this did happen.
Pardon me?
But on this occasion, somebody came up to you and said that.
Yeah, and he had actually gone to the hospital, which was concerning. So I don't know what the details are, and maybe it was a longer altercation, or maybe it was, I'm not sure what happened, but he did not look too well.
Well, I'm hoping that I can get in touch with him and talk to him. We can get his direct account. You, I presume, have not talked to the police department about this either.
No, I haven't.
And I hope I'm not, it sounds like I am outing you here on the air on this issue. I guess maybe there'll be some more investigation into this. We have, of course, a Citizens Police Review Board auditor who is, for my money, completely useless. The board, who he replaced in 2003, this is Bob Aronson, a nice enough guy, but all he does is issue secret reports to the police department, to the city council about the police department, which we don't get to see. So it's doesn't mean much, you know. But, of course, before, when we had the Citizens Police Review Board, on only two occasions, well, on one occasion they had an independent investigation, and they actually found that an activist, Steve Argue, was assaulted with excessive force. Perhaps the word assault is not accurate, because Officer Lefevre, who assaulted him, in my view, was not charged with criminal assault. He was simply, you know, making an arrest after Argue had punched him in the face in order to stop his twisting the arm of a woman holding a child in a political protest back in 1999. But the it's difficult to have any meaningful police monitoring these days, and I think that what we do on the air here is we ask people to observe what's going on, to report in to Free Radio, to making a complaint to the police department's professional standards unit, which is their suggestion if there's a police office, police behavior you see that you don't like. The professional standards unit is the new word for internal affairs, as I understand it.
Right.
It doesn't really result in anything unless you have an independent investigation of some kind and some group with some real power. But the media can have some impact. So, for example, exposés in the San Francisco Chronicle would show that the same cops keep using, you know, the same violent tactics and keep being, you know, essentially supported and sustained by the San Francisco Police Department, even though their successful lawsuits are maintained against them, can have ultimately have an impact. At least I'm hoping that ultimately they'll have an impact. Maybe they don't have any impact. I don't know. You're from the Bay Area recently, before this?
I grew up in Fremont, yeah.
So Fremont, for some of that sends a chill up my spine. How are the Fremont police, or should I ask you about the police? You're in a sort of a delicate political position here.
You can ask me. Fremont, when I was there, I lived there until 1980. It was like a little kind of semi-suburban ranch town, and, you know, it was just kind of a little town. And then I spent 29 years in L.A., and saw a lot of changes going on there with police and police tactics. And the big news, or the poster child situation was with the Rampart Department, where they were planting drugs on persons. They were putting them in handcuffs, and they actually shot somebody in handcuffs, and just all sorts of abuses. At that time, they appointed a commission to examine, you know, all the police activities in L.A. and come up with a better solution, you know, a better approach.
My impression was they didn't come up with anything and it all fizzled out. But what was your impression?
Well, I think, you know, the Rampart-ish situation happened under Chief Gates. And, you know, when he moved on, then I think there was a much different mentality. You know, keeping in mind in the 80s, in L.A., they were doing things like taking this, you know, gigantic, what's that called? They took a tank and they attached a battering ram on it, and they were busting through these, you know, crack houses and, you know, basically destroying these homes with this tank. You know, that was their tactic related to how we're going to manage this drug issue. So you could, you know, it was a real heavy-handed approach. Since then, it's significantly become more civil and humane, in my opinion.
Unless, of course, you're a homeless person in Skid Row, where police are now enjoined from arresting you for sleeping outside, but instead they will give you tickets for jaywalking or a multitude of other so-called crimes in order to essentially drive you out of the area so the area can be redeveloped for gentrification purposes.
I don't believe that I disagree with that.
In fact, I'm hoping you get in touch with LA CAN, Los Angeles Community Action Network, which has been doing some. They do kind of regular research there, though their website is definitely not up to date. And, you know, I know you do to go down there regularly, and, you know, you got a lot of stuff to do. I'm going to keep encouraging you to look in on them while you're down there.
Yeah, I think what's happened, you know, you're correct, though. I mean, I'm not saying that they're doing anything right or wrong. I really don't know exactly how they're approaching, you know, these homeless persons But, you know, a huge amount of the homeless are concentrated right in that nickel district in L.A. I actually oversaw Harbor Light, which is right there, which is the Salvation Army program. And, you know, they were really, I believe that they were making an effort to clean it up and to disperse the homeless so that transportation could move through that area. That's my opinion. I don't know if that's based in any actual fact. It's just my observance of working downtown for 9 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, so. Los Angeles has become a community that has ended its sleeping ban, at least nominally, because of the Jones settlement. The Jones was the plaintiff, and you know the city was sued. And rather than appeal the suit, they went into a settlement. Same in San Diego, same in Laguna Beach. Richmond changed its law. Palo Alto does not criminalize sleeping in vehicles. And yet in Santa Cruz, it's illegal to sleep at night. Your homeless service center issues letters to homeless people who come in saying, we're full, we couldn't give them a place to stay. There was no shelter that night. So, you know, that which should be the basis for a clear dismissal of a ticket based on the necessity defense. Have you been issuing a lot of these letters? Do you have any stats on that?
I don't believe we've been issuing any of those letters.
Really?
I don't know. That would happen probably in our day center. And it wouldn't really be something that I would need to sign or would run past me. I can ask, but I don't recall that being something that's coming up too often.
I actually did see a letter recently, so I know your folks have issued at least one letter. If you can find out the stats, I'd be curious.
Yeah, I can find that out. That's not a problem at all.
But, I mean, I'm just wondering, the previous Homeless Service Center Executive Director, Ken Cole, when asked to oppose the sleeping ban, he actually did oppose the entire camping ordinance back in 1999 when he was Vice Chair of the Homeless Issues Task Force, which report I encourage you to look at online if you haven't already seen it. I may have mentioned it to you before. I think I did. I think I gave you a copy of it, actually. You came to a meeting, and we showed you the Homeless Issues Task Force report from 99 here in Santa Cruz.
Right.
Yet since then, there's been no public position by the board of the Homeless Service Center about the criminalization of the homeless people in terms of sleeping, perhaps because, you know, there are lots of merchants, police, judges, and other essentially complicitors in this policy on the board, Don Lane being one of them. Lane has refused to take any action on this issue for either as a council member and mayor when he was a mayor in the early 90s up until now when he was reelected last year. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for, you know, homeless advocates who won't stand up for homeless people under the most basic conditions around the issue, let's say, of sleeping somewhere, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere legally at night. And I'm not asking you to defend his position, you know, because, you know, you have other relationships with him. But what about your position there yourself? I guess you're the Homeless Service Center issues these letters. I mean, at least they were. They issued at least one letter. I saw it.
I guess.
So, and you're going to give me hopefully some more stats. You're not really expanding shelter, though, for the winter. The armory is going to be gone. Instead, you've got a nearby warehouse, which is more convenient and should be ready by November. Is that right? Or?
We're actually not going to be able to move up to Harvey West this winter because we just couldn't get everything together in time. And basically, we just couldn't secure a warehouse. We couldn't get the renovations completed necessary, and then, you know, to negotiate the city codes related to building, it wasn't going to happen in the time frame that I had hoped for. So we are back up at the armory.
I see.
Related to the board, and I believe that I've said this before to you, the board recuses itself from taking a political position or making a formal political position on the sleeping ban and other, you know, issues. And my role and the board's role is to provide housing and services, but not necessarily to take a position on a political issue.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you've probably been following some of the controversy in Sacramento, maybe, because I think you're on the I said, I've sent you a few things. Sacramento activists have been, you know, arrested repeatedly with the involvement of activists and board members even. I think maybe I'm wrong about the board member, but workers with the Loaves and Fishes, which provide sort of analogous services to homeless people in Sacramento.
Right.
You know, and so it's interesting to me that just as the ACLU in Santa Cruz wants to have nothing to do with the sleeping ban, I think they can't really claim it's a political issue because that's what ACLU is involved in. They don't say anything. They just say, oh, we're researching it further. That's what we've been saying for 20 years. The Homeless Service Center Board, of which you are, I guess, the executive director, and you know that they pay your salary, has now claimed this is a political issue. Actually, it's a survival issue for poor and homeless people. And you know, what's do you have? I mean, what's your reaction to this? I'm asking you to talk. I guess you can, if you want to separate your position as a paid employee from that as an individual human being who's looking at this, you can. You know, but go ahead.
So that is something that is a conundrum to me. Okay, the sleeping ban or the camping ban. In that, it's hard for me to understand if we're not going to expand shelter space for homeless persons, right? If we're not going to accommodate the homeless, yet we're going to cite them for not having shelter. I mean, it's a bit nonsensical, if that makes sense. Because it's illogical and there's no winning. There's no resolution. There's no solution. And in fact, beyond that, there's not even a strategy. Because if you can't come up with a solution, come up with a strategy. So there's no strategy and there's no solution to this poor guy who, you know, for whatever reason, whether he's addicted to drugs and alcohol and or alcohol, whether he has mental illness issues, whether he has social skills deficits that precludes him from, you know, obtaining employment. You know, you've got a guy who, for whatever reason, is not necessarily able to follow the path that most people follow. So we have this guy who can't find shelter and he sleeps outside, yet he's cited for that. It doesn't make any sense to me personally. So,
have you said as much to your board by any chance?
You know, the board is, you know, we operate about a significant portion of our budget comes from private contributions, and our private contributions come from a range of people with political opinions. Okay, so you know, as the executive director, and I'll speak on behalf of the board, it's not appropriate for us to take a position which might ultimately reduce our private donations and then negatively affect the services that we're currently providing, if that makes sense.
Unless your mission is specifically having to do with the well-being of homeless people, and it is such a clear, has such a clear impact on the well-being of homeless people, that not to take a position is, in fact, to endorse a form of abuse against homeless people, in which case, I guess, you're going to take donations from people who prefer to see the continuation of abuse of homeless people while maintaining the hypocritical posture that they're helping what amounts to a fraction of the homeless community.
Well, I think everybody has a role, you know, and our role is to provide housing and services to homeless persons. You're obviously an advocate of changing political policy, and you know, I respect you greatly for that. I think you do a good job of really aggressively asking questions and not just letting, you know, the status quo be, or not settling for the status quo. You know, our position is that you know, we are here to provide services for this small amount of people.
We're talking with Homeless Service Center Executive Director Doug Loisel, who is one of the few Homeless Service Center directors you can actually reach by phone. I know you could never do that with Ken Cole, and I don't think you could do that much with Karen Gillette before him when she was part of the prior organization. Is there a way to reach you, Doug, if people have further questions for you, complaints, concerns, if they themselves were beaten up last night by the police and want to bring it to your attention?
I think I should give out my cell phone number on the air.
I don't know if you should or not. I'm leaving that up to you. Maybe there's an email address, although homeless people don't usually. You say you're on the lot, or as you would say, the campus of the homeless service center. What, frequently during the day? Is there a particular schedule you follow that will enable people to find you?
I am on the campus, and all a person has to do is ask. And if they go into the front desk and they ask for me, unless I'm doing something that I just can't stop, generally speaking, I just invite them into my office, no matter who it is. So, it's not like people need to make an appointment or anything. If somebody has a complaint or an issue or a concern, I'm more than happy to hear them either, on site, out of my office, or if they come by the office, they're free to stop by and see me. And I think if you ask people, they'll let you know that that's accurate. And then I can give my office phone. That's not a problem.
458-6020?
Yeah, extension 2103. And that's my direct line.
So that's 458-6020, extension 2103. Any numbers? Go ahead.
Or if you dial 458-6020, you can just press 3, and that will also go to my phone.
Okay.
My direct line.
Extension 3 should work then, just 3. Great. I appreciate you taking 45 minutes while driving, and I hope you're not talking on the phone illegally. I would have to report.
No, I have my headphones on.
All right, then. And
all right, Robert.
Hey, thank you very much, and give me the report from L.A. If and when you come across it.
L.A. can. I got it.
All right. You can, and so can they.
Thanks. All right. Thanks, Robert. You have a good evening.
You too, man. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care.
And that was Doug Loisel. Again, 458-6020, extension 3. That's his machine, if you want to try to reach him. I'm not sure if it operates at night. It might. And so you might be able to get a hold of him there. You're tuned, and I'm talking on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.1 FM, previously 89.3 FM. Before that, was it 96.3 FM? We've been all over the dial, but we're 101.1 FM right now. And we have about 15 minutes left in the show. You can call in 427-3772 if you'd like. I'm going to play a few street interviews while I can. But callers take precedence. Hey there, caller. How you doing? Can you hear me? Hello? All right, looks like the caller wants to talk to me off air. We're going to go to the street interviews directly.
So with me here at Alfredo's.
Assuming we can get Mickey Mouse off the air here. Hang on.
So with me here at Alfredo's, or Alfresco's actually, a little different, is
Stephen Argue.
And Steve, you're selling copies of The Internationalist. How are sales downtown?
Pretty good.
And you're also a man who has just been advised that Badass Coffee has gone out of business, to which your response is?
Good.
And is that because you don't like coffee, because you have a disagreement with the Badass management? What exactly didn't you like about Badass Coffee?
Before they even opened up shop, they had a sign in their window opposing raising the minimum wage in Santa Cruz. So I never went in there. I never spent any money there.
But wasn't that typical? Didn't every business along the avenue, perhaps even including Alfresco's, oppose raising the minimum wage?
No, I have a pro on my ball.
Ah, Marilyn did have a pro, Steve.
Yeah, don't accuse her.
Certainly not. Well, having accused her, I withdraw my accusation.
Yeah, but Badass Coffee were up front. They hadn't even opened up shop yet, and they had a sign opposing raising the minimum wage. So that made it clear to me where they were coming from.
You make it a practice, for example, of not patronizing businesses that didn't support raising the minimum wage?
I don't know. I probably have patronized a number of them that did oppose it, but they were just that it just stuck out. You know, the fact that they hadn't even opened up shop here yet, and they were already campaigning against raising it. I mean, it just stuck in my memory because of that. I think partly, but you know, I mean, we live in a capitalist country. We live in a country where just about any time we buy any product, there's exploitation going on, and you can't just really boycott to change society all that much. But you know, at times, you know, I'm not going to spend my money certain places. But I think our real strength is through the organized working class and being able to shut them down. You know, for instance, if workers here in downtown Santa Cruz were organized, we could have a higher minimum wage by shutting down all these businesses that are refusing to pay more.
And if renters were organized, we could perhaps do a rent strike.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, a lot of that probably will come out of bigger industries becoming better organized, becoming more of a inspiration for people to fight back. But that's, I think, where our real strength is at as workers and being organized as workers to fight back.
So as a man who's observed the Santa Cruz scene for more than a decade, how is the organizing going in Santa Cruz?
I haven't been too active doing too much organizing. I think we're at a point where I think the most important thing that can be done is building a revolutionary cadre opposed to capitalism that is built on the revolutionary program of socialism, for smashing capitalism and imperialism through workers' revolution. And in building such an organization, I think that's where we're really going to change anything. All these pressure politics, all these people who've tried to rely on the Democrats to try to change anything and pressure them, it's gotten nowhere. In fact, we've been going backwards for the last 30 years. And what we really need to do is build a revolutionary movement.
And how's that coming in Santa Cruz?
Well, like I said, you know, I'm not as active as I have been in the past, but there are a number of people who are sympathetic to it, and I'm working on getting out the ideas. And basically, that's, you know, there's nothing big to boast of, but that's where I stand. I stand with my ideas, and I think that's the most important thing. You know, you can be in a reactionary political time, which we are now, and not be able to hold any kind of political power, not really be in a position to pressure the system all that much or at all. But the most important thing is not to give up our ideas. And that's where I'm at, is not giving up my ideas and continuing to stand up for those ideas, put those ideas out in this magazine, The Internationalist, occasionally writing some things. I could be more active, but I'm going to school, and I think that's important for me right now, too.
And, Steve, you were, of course, a candidate in 2000 and 2002 for the Santa Cruz Shitty Council, as some of us in our adolescent frenzy call the council.
Yes, I was. And in doing that, I opposed all of these fake leftist, fake liberals on the city council who, for instance, you know, talking about the minimum wage, when that struggle was going on, or before that went on, that was part of my platform when I ran for city council, was raising the minimum wage, doubling the minimum wage in Santa Cruz. And Mike Rockin, the fake socialist,
oncoming mayor
on the city council, this guy, he mocked me. He publicly mocked me, saying, "You can't raise the minimum wage. A municipality can't do that," which was a lie. And he knew it. But he said, "If we could, we would have done it a long time ago." So what happens? San Francisco does raise their minimum wage through a ballot initiative.
Santa Fe does.
And Santa Fe. And so it gets on the ballot here. What does Mike Rockin do then? He publicly opposes it. He campaigns against it. So the guy's a liar. And this is typical of him on just about every issue. He says he's for something. He's one of the most reactionary people. He's just as reactionary as the rest of them in government.
There is currently being proposed
I see a smoker walking by. A smoking ban on Pacific Avenue, Beach Street, and other places. What's your reaction to that?
I don't care about that.
Sorry.
I just don't. As a non-smoker, I think, you know, I don't want to give the cops more power to hassle people on the one hand. So I have some ambivalence, but on the other hand, I don't like breathing in people's smoke. I think that's kind of a form of violence too.
It's uncomfortable and gives you a sore throat.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking with Steve Argue, and Steve, any plans to be either for revolution or possibly political activity in the next year?
Well, I'm doing some political activity right now. I'm distributing the Internationalist right here, putting out ideas. And this is the kind of activity that I'm comfortable in doing at this moment because I don't have a huge amount of time to commit to organizing things.
Hear, hear. Steve Halper has gone to jail repeatedly on numerous causes, in numerous causes dear to my heart. For instance, he was at this very place 11 years ago selling Street Spirit newspaper.
Yes, I was. And I had just been the day before at a protest against the police murder of Happy John Dine. I had written an article on that, which had been circulated in Socialist Action newspaper in town here. And I was on the second page of the Santa Cruz Sentinel with two of the elected city council people at that protest of 100 people. There was a picture of that. Officer Garner came down the street. His first question was, do I have a license to sell the paper, which I replied I didn't need a license. I continued to try to sell it, tried to inform him that it's a First Amendment right to freedom to distribute the press. It's part of the First Amendment. But I was thrown to the ground, brutalized, thrown in jail for 3 days. And I won a lawsuit against the city where Federal Judge Ware ruled that not only was this a violation of free speech rights, but the way the city government was trying to defend itself showed that it was city policy to violate free speech rights. So I was able to overturn that practice of hassling vendors of various newspapers, including street newspapers and socialist newspapers here in Santa Cruz.
And indeed, police, with a few exceptions, have pretty much kept their hands off street spirit salesmen if and when they ever show up. Steve, thank you for giving me the time of day. I'm going to rush back to my parking meter so as to avoid a $30 or a $40 ticket. I forgot which.
Okay, don't pay them a cent more than you have to.
Good advice.
And we actually have waiting patiently on the phone. Turn down your radio there, Drummer Dave.
Gotcha, man.
We have Drummer Dave from...
Hey, what's going on?
...from the Wednesday Drum Circle. Dave, I wanted to read you this this email from Vision Song Valerie, who observed how you and other drummers and other people at the Drum Circle handled an outbreak of violence there. You want me give me a moment to read it to you?
Sure, go ahead.
This is what Valerie writes. I went to the Drum Circle about 6 p.m. and some kids that were not hippies started a fight right in front of the Drum Circle, and the drummers stopped, surrounded them, asked them to leave, and managed to verbally move them away from the Drum Circle and police themselves nicely without further incidents. I guess there's a better word than policing because there was no thug energy in how they did it. I was impressed and complimented everyone for the nice work they did at policing themselves. I said, everything is okay. Nice job. We don't need police. We can police ourselves. And the drumming went on. Any comments, Dave?
Yeah, that's basically what happened. The kids got into a scuffle, though. They still had to show that they had that testosterone flowing, you know. But we told them both to take it to the levee, you know, take it out of town. You know, take their problems elsewhere.
And they did?
And they did. It seemed to be an altercation over a dog who this girl said that it lunged at her, and the boyfriend was concerned and went to talk to the man, and the man decided to have a fight with him, you know, over his dog, in denial of his dog.
And police were called, but they didn't get there, as I understand it.
Well, no, I think it was just a ploy. I think it was, you know, I'm going to call the police on you. And
So I know that I was actually present the week before when the Sergeant Harms and one of his fellow officers took into custody a guy on a probation or parole violation for, I don't know, walking to Pacific Avenue or being on Pacific Avenue, although he didn't specify that's what it was. They always have this mysterious, we don't know what we're arresting you for, it's just a parole violation.
Right. Yeah, they did take a man away last week.
Yeah, was there any police action yesterday at the drum circle?
None. Just a drive-by. They just drove by. They didn't shoot anyone.
Well, you know, you got to work a little harder. This is not very exciting radio.
You know, we didn't have any eggs or anything to... put them on the spot, you know.
Make nasty comments.
We didn't have
to do something.
We didn't have magic markers or,
you know, kick up the,
you know,
pump up the
chalk
volume,
sticks.
You know, kick up the
we
drama.
Didn't have any of those.
Well, Dave, I want to thank you for calling. I have about 6 minutes left.
Yes,
so
six minutes, Rob. Hey, nice show. And I wanted to say, what a connection with the homeless guy, Doug.
Doug Loisel.
Loisel.
He's not a homeless guy. He's a well-paid bureaucrat.
That was great
bureaucrat.
Mentioning...
But, you know, he's a nice guy for sure to come on here.
Lito and Anna.
So what,
if he could talk to the, you know.
Yeah, I actually wanted to talk to him about, you know, Ana Miguel and Miguel de Leon, Lito and Anna as they're called, because they were in the paper a week ago. There's this supposed, we're trying to help this poor couple, you know, with their housing situation. When probably all they really want to do is be left fucking alone, you know, to do what they need to do in their own lives, just not to be hassled. And that, of course, isn't happening because of the whole structure of laws that's set up to harass homeless people in Santa Cruz just for doing life-sustaining activity.
Yes, and I was glad to hear of the homeless facility up near, what is it, UCSC, or is that just...
That's the Homeless Service Center out of Highway 1 and River Street.
No, but doesn't he have like a day center, he said, where they
same.
Can go
it's
and
the,
hang out?
It's the same place. It used to be closed during the day to the homeless except for very limited purposes. Now he's declared it's open.
Oh, so there was a, and it's got a 24-hour bathroom.
And for the first time in Santa Cruz history, a 24-hour bathroom.
Besides the ones that are locked. On the mall,
right? Those are the,
at 12 o'clock or something,
or often frequently before that. Even
where a guy runs up and he's trying to get in the door because he's got to go so bad, and then there it is on the is his pants, and then the policeman drives by and up another drunk. Let's go throw him in jail.
Now, that's a very cynical view of our police department, Dave. I'm going to have to cut
I've just had enough of you
and your attacks on our.
You know, and hey, he was the mayor's son, but hell, they didn't know it was too dark.
All right, I'm going to leave you. Thank you for calling
in. No, but
in,
hey, man. Listen, you take care, Rob.
Bye-bye.
Peace, Santa Cruz.
Yeah, we have about 5 minutes left. I'm not going to tell you who's in the studio, but if it's vegetable, animal, or mineral, I'll tell you which of the three. If anybody calls in, you do have those of you who've been waiting desperately by the phones to get in. 4 minutes in which to talk, unless, of course, I can cajole a few minutes from Uncle Dennis's endlessly long 3-hour show from the cream to the dregs. Actually, I suppose I probably won't have that opportunity. Let's hear a few more street interviews. I really intended to play more, but I didn't take the time because of this long interview with Loisel, which I think was good, but perhaps may have gone on a tad too long.
Well, here we are downtown again, about 5 o'clock, outside of New Leaf Market on Pacific Avenue on September 17th, I think we're at, or is it the 18th? I don't know. It's a Friday. I think it's the 17th. The 18th, thank you. And I'm tolerating the hot weather, although I guess it's not that hot. It's going to be hotter tomorrow or the day after, they say. Maybe next week. Anyway, heat waves are hitting. And munching away on his burrito, and hence somewhat unintelligible in his speech, is Lee, who is a man who, shall we say, met his match at City Hall while sleeping there illegally last night.
Well, I didn't really meet my match. I just met a police officer about 11:30 at night. He woke me up. It's the second time in approximately a week. Last week there were a lot more people there. There's like a rotating crew. Some are regulars. Some come and go. I don't think he liked my response to to a question he asked me, which was, see, they come for me now. They know I'm talking to you, Robert.
Hang on a second here. As the siren disappears into the distance, where were you sleeping at City Hall?
I was sleeping over near the chamber's door. I don't want to get too specific about it because it might screw someone else's spot up, you know. But
there were a number of people sleeping there in the last week, you say?
Oh, yeah. There's always at least one other person there, sometimes as many as five or six, and a crew of alcoholics that come around, and the police are never there when they're there, of course. But basically, he asked me if I had any relatives in the area. I don't know why he asked me that question. Maybe to just tell me, so why don't you go stay with them or some snotty thing. And I looked at him and said, actually, all my relatives were on the East Coast. And he looked at me like I was a transient. So I had to inform him that basically I've lived here for 33 years and I'm just homeless at a time where there's no work around here and I'm unemployed at the moment. For the last 4 months, and no, I'm not a transient, and I don't think he didn't like the fact that he was dealing with someone that was homeless and not transient, because that is a propaganda and a bird is deep into their own skulls too, and when they find something that, you know, bangs up against the propaganda they've been fed, it irritates them. Or perhaps he wants to use me as a crash test dummy because I can be terribly contemptuous in court.
In his great campaign against the sleeping ban, he wants you as his champion.
Maybe he just doesn't like the municipal court judges and wants him to have a very hard time with me. It beats having plead outs and no-shows, and that's no fun at all. For someone to directly confront a judge about the socioeconomic mess they've made out of this town, I don't think a judge will tolerate that sort of talk for very long. And it would be entirely contemptuous, but it's not contemptuous in the traditional sense of the word. I just want to know what he might like to do.
So you'll probably be taking your ticket to court, perhaps, after a month or two or three or four, whenever it appears on the calendar.
No. I'm going to be prompt. He told me to be there within a month. I'm going to be there next week, and if it's not on file, I'm going to ask the clerk to get the supervisor to find out why, because I made a trip down there after a short period of time, like the officer said I should do, and why hadn't the paperwork been filed? And maybe I'll just walk into court with the ticket and deal with it right there.
I hope so, but if it doesn't appear on the court records, even if the ticket is in your hand, they will. Although I think that'd be an interesting test case, because
you can walk into court with the ticket in the hand and walk up to the bailiff and say, "I want to deal with this now."
I've never heard of it actually happening, but if it actually did, in your case, I'd like to hear more details. I know that for years they've been at least a month or two behind in the calendar. In fact, I've never heard of any there actually being a case where it occurs. So that when you actually do what they say on the ticket, come back within a month, you get a court date. That has never happened, to my knowledge. So.
Well, then they have a problem. They're wasting my time, and I'll bill them for it.
I would hope so.
No, it's really simple to do.
Well, I expect it here. Not only are you going to bill them, but I want to see that you carry through the court case once you actually are successful.
They are not entitled to waste.
I'm tired of getting pulled around, and then they're saying I'm grabbing my crotch, you know, the officer, and I got to be moved around.
And we will leave at this dramatic moment because I am over time, and the dregs have come in to deal with Uncle Dennis's From the Cream to the Dregs. And taking over will be, is it Rutabaga Rick?
That's right.
Rutabaga Rick is going to be covering the show. I want to thank you for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I will be back on Sunday. You can check me out then at 9:30 in the morning. If you want to catch me beforehand, do give a call to the Huff Line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And if you want to volunteer to do something, I will find something for you to do. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides.
Middle of the summer, midnight lies and sleep, sitting in a crowded apartment, about 110 degrees. I went outside the middle of the night. All I had was a match in my hand. I wanted to fight, so I said, burn, baby, burn. No one to eat, and Lord, and no one to see, and now nowhere to turn. Burn, baby, burn. I called President Johnson on the phone. The secretary said he wasn't there. I tried to get in touch with Mr. Humphrey. He couldn't find him anywhere. I went into the courtroom with my poor black feet. Didn't have no money, didn't have no lawyer. They wouldn't plead my case. So I said, burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. No one leave, and Lord, and no one to see.
And welcome, everybody, to From the Cream to the Dregs. This is Rough and Ready Rutabaga Rick, filling in for Coral, who's on her way in, and filling in for the ever-popular Uncle Dennis. A couple of hecklers here in the studio. And welcome. It is 8:05.
just a dream.